Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. When a president takes office, his first official act is to swear to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. But what does that mean? And what does it mean today? Well, my guest today decided to write a book on what that has entailed for past presidents and wrote about the times when they may have violated that oath and what it should mean for future presidents. Corey Brettschneider is a professor of political science at Brown University and the author of The Oath and the Office, a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. He's written on constitutional law and politics for the New York Times, Time.com, and Politico. He'll be a guest of the University of Tulsa's Honors Program and the Phi Beta Kappa Program. He'll be giving the Phi Beta Kappa lecture virtually this afternoon at 5 on his book, The Oath and the Office. Information on how to watch is available on the university's events page at utulsa.edu, and you look for the events calendar. Corey Brettschneider is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Professor Brettschneider, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, it's often said that the presidency of Donald J. Trump has been norm-busting. You hear it all the time. Mm-hmm. And I know that you wrote, as a constitutional and presidential scholar, that the Trump candidacy and presidency has forced you to confront far-fetched classroom hypotheticals in real life. How has the Trump presidency influenced the office and power of the presidency in the long term?
I think that it is probably closest in many ways, most recently, to the presidency of Richard Nixon in terms of the accusations, credible accusations of crimes and abuses of power from within the White House. And I think, though, this time, it's not one president where we can say this is a one-time anomaly, the president resigned. It's a president who's really determined to stay in power despite these abuses of power. And to my mind, the real lessons have to be nonpartisan. We have to start to think about the office of the presidency. So let me just give you one quick example. As a result of precedents from the Nixon and Clinton White Houses, memos written by the Justice Department in both the Clinton and Nixon administrations, sitting presidents can't be subject to criminal indictment. Now, why is that? The argument is that there's something special about the executive branch of government, that the president would be distracted by these prosecutions, that the dignity of the office also is incompatible with the idea of prosecuting a sitting president. But that's not found in the Constitution the way it is in some constitutions, like the Constitution of Israel. And it defies, I think, the basic moral principle of our Constitution, which is that no person is above the law. And so I think we've really got to rethink that idea that presidents can't be prosecuted, to try to clarify the idea that they can through legislation, and to push forward with policies that really hold presidents accountable. Relatedly, I think we need to bring back the independent counsel law, in which the person investigating the president doesn't work for the president. Robert Mueller, as your listeners might know, was part of the Justice Department, technically an employee of the executive branch. And that's just a weird setup where the person investigating the president works for the president. We had a law after Nixon that Clinton allowed to expire in which the person investigating the president was independent, where they couldn't be fired by the president, the more common sense approach. And I think we've got to bring that back.
You write that the precedent may be the Nixon presidency, and you did see the presidency weaken somewhat, but that was very short-lived for the most part.
Yes. There was a period of time, I mean, in the course of American history, I think that's right. But I look at the Ford and Carter presidencies differently than we might have in the past, especially after Trump. There were laws passed, I think, with the aim of trying to rein in the president and the office of the president, not any specific president. So I mentioned the independent counsel. There also was an Emergencies Act that was aimed at giving two houses the ability to stop the president from creating a national emergency. This president has claimed, to my mind, a fake emergency at the border and used it to try to justify building the wall. Under the kind of legislation, the version of the Emergencies Act that was originally passed, the House and Senate alone could stop it. But that got transformed, where now the legislation's been amended to require the president to sign off on the end of an emergency. An act that was supposed to stop an emergency wound up just increasing presidential power. The War Powers Act was also passed towards the end of the Nixon presidency, with an aim of trying to limit presidential power. but it's, I think, in its what was seen as a sort of reasonable accommodation for presidents to give them a time period before they had to seek congressional approval. They've abused that power, not just Republican presidents, Democratic presidents as well. And I think, you know, we've got to fix that, too, to really restore Congress's ability to declare or initiate war. So there was a lot done. You're right. Certainly it was a period of time that was somewhat brief in our history. And eventually, I think all of that legislation got undermined. But they had the right instinct, I think, in trying to rein in the executive branch.
As I was thinking about the power of the presidency, there are very few abhorrent presidencies where you see this, you know, abuse of power and the power immediately taken back. Power evolves, and generally each president evolves that power in some way, and the next president uses it, maybe sometimes directly in a contradictory way than the previous president that claimed that power.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. Often the tendency in American history has been to aggrandize power, but we have had these periods of pushback. So if we go to the, especially if we go earlier in our history, so if you think of the 19th century, the first President Johnson, Andrew Johnson, was a president who was giving speeches proclaiming white supremacy. He had an explicit concern to bring back white supremacy, to push back against the forces of equality, of Reconstruction. And that presidency turned into a disaster. He was, of course, impeached by the House, and there was one vote short of removing him by the Senate, but he wasn't even nominated by his own party after. So that's an example of pushback. Now, if we go even earlier, I think the election of 1800 is in many ways a repudiation of the Adams presidency, in particular the Alien and Sedition Acts, the practice of Adams and the Federalist Party of making it illegal to criticize the president. So we've been here before, I think, and if we look to those moments, I think that's where we can get our best lesson of going forward, of really trying to push back against this trend that you've noted of increased presidential power.
You're going to speak on The Oath and the Office, your book from 2018, and you wrote The Oath and Office, I believe, as a fireside chat for future presidential candidates. What do they need to know about seeking the presidency?
The book begins with that idea that, you know, the office is a constitutional office. And here's just a simple fact for listeners to see that. Article 1 creates the Congress and limits it. Article 2 creates the presidency and limits it. And, of course, Article 3, the judiciary. And Article 2 lays out the only oath word for word to be taken by federal officials. Lots of officials take an oath, but only one is specified word for word. And what the president has to promise is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. That's what he or she solemnly swears to do, and those words are written out word for word. And the idea that it's prescribed the first few seconds in office is really a symbol of what I'm talking about, the idea that the president doesn't have the power to do anything he or she wants, but the presidency is created and limited by the Constitution. So I think requiring the president to say those words is meant to speak to the notion of constraint. So presidents want to do a variety of things, and my book isn't trying to tell them what their policy should be, but it is trying to teach that basic lesson to all future presidents that this is a constitutional office, and the thing that gives you power has to be respected, and that's the Constitution of the United States.
What limitation to presidential power has most been ignored in your mind in the last couple of decades?
I mentioned the war power. The Constitution is really clear that presidents do not initiate war, that Congress does, and I think that's really fallen out. I think, too, there is less of a sense of the need for legislation the more we see executive orders. It's Congress that's supposed to make law, and the president that's supposed to carry them out, and you know that's one place where Congress needs to step up more. Another power, I would say, that in recent years, really the last 4 years, I think those are not specific to Trump, those two examples, but I will give one specific to Trump. The idea of preserving, protecting, and defending the Constitution is certainly something that a president is supposed to do, but it also speaks to what they're supposed to say. The power of the bully pulpit, I think, really, you know, if you look at Washington's second inaugural, we've strayed so far from that. There isn't an idea of the bully pulpit then. It comes much later in the 20th century. But what Washington says in the second inaugural address, the shortest ever given, is, I just took the oath of office, and if I fail to respect it, I want you, the people, the representatives assembled before me, to hold me to account. And if I fail to live up to it, to speak in favor of it, I want you to upbraid me or criticize me, and if I really fail, to subject me to constitutional punishment. He's using presidential speech to speak in favor of the Constitution, in favor of the limited presidency. And you really don't see that with Trump. There's no sense of constraint. There's a sense, too, I think, of not recognizing that there's a duty to defend values like equal protection under law, saying that there are good people on both sides when we're talking about white supremacists, ignores the obligation that the Constitution and its Equal Protection Clause puts on a president to defend the idea that we're all equals under law. And I think that applies to his actions as well. I was a big opponent of the travel ban because I thought it was based in animus, and the dissent in the Supreme Court agreed with my amicus brief about that, but the majority didn't. And the lesson of that case, I think, is that even though we expect courts to be the ones to enforce the Constitution, they often won't. And that's why we really need presidents to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, their actions, like not having a travel ban, and in what they say and what they're expected to say beyond the minimum to really defend the Constitution in robust terms.
You know, it's interesting you said, you know, the courts often won't defend the Constitution. They're very loath to defend the Constitution on a particular president while he is in power. It seems to me they're far more likely to restrain presidential power after that presidency's over, mm-hmm. or after that issue has been decided, and sort of set a future precedent rather than a current, we're operating in a crisis.
That's right. Yeah, I think the court has a fear of being seen as partisan, but often, you know, its fear has led it in the opposite direction, that it's undermined rather than protected the Constitution. And unfortunately, that's a long tradition of courts undermining the Constitution rather than defending it. If you think of that Alien and Sedition Act, there was a Supreme Court justice lobbying for that act rather than striking it down. The courts were never going to strike it down. It was really only Jefferson and Madison and their resistance to that act and in the election of 1800 that it was repudiated, allowed to expire. The Dred Scott case, of course, is a terrible instance of courts failing in their duty when the court said in Dred Scott that African Americans aren't even people under the law. So there's a long tradition of them failing to stand up to power. And, you know, I think that the result should be to criticize them when they don't. And I've been very critical of that travel ban case. But it's also to put the obligation on we the people that we need to defend the Constitution by electing presidents who are going to respect it. We need to defend the Constitution by pointing out these issues and making them central in addition to the policy issues that dominate the day, to see civil liberties as something that we demand be respected, not just hope that for courts to do that. And we do that in the questions we ask presidents and what we demand of them in our elections, what's on the agenda. And, you know, throughout time, individuals have formed organizations to lobby for constitutional reform. I think that we did see that in that era that we were talking about after Nixon, and that's really something that we need to do again. We need a lobbyist on behalf of the Constitution and a lobby for the people.
My guest today is Corey Bretschneider. He's a professor of political science at Brown University. He's the author of the 2018 book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. It's published by Norton, and he'll be speaking on that to the University of Tulsa Phi Beta Kappa chapter in a public lecture this evening at 5, available on Zoom. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, earlier you were talking about a lot of those limitations on powers that have been eroded, and you talked about the War Powers Act and, you know, the Congress not passing legislation and leaving it to presidents to use executive power through executive orders. But in both of those cases, it's Congress, a lot of times critics will say it's Congress abdicating its authority in putting limitations on adventurism with militaries overseas, or not passing legislation and being in gridlock and not coming to a compromise to address an issue that a president addresses through an executive order.
I think that's right. It's sometimes handing over power, and there are instances, I think, that Emergencies Act as amended is an example of that, where this thing that was meant to limit the ability of presidents to declare unlimited emergencies winds up aggrandizing their power eventually after it's amended, after its initial form. And that's something that Congress needs to push back on. Sometimes it's negligence. I'm very concerned about the pardon power. I have a piece in The Atlantic about why one of the original true concerns of the framers in the 18th century in the Philadelphia Convention is that a president is going to use the pardon power to pardon co-conspirators. And I talk about George Mason, the Virginia delegation in general, worrying about that. And many people think that the president's power to pardon is unlimited, and certainly this president has claimed that. But what I'm arguing in the piece is that the framers were concerned to limit pardons when it came to co-conspirators, and that's part of the true meaning, although it's been forgotten, of accepting cases of impeachment. They didn't want to allow presidents to pardon co-conspirators that were connected to cases of their own impeachment. Now, that's not something that courts are likely to take up tomorrow. I try to give the history for why that's right, but it is something that Congress can try to legislate on. I do believe that Congress has to claim that power, though. They can't just allow passively and hope for the best. And so denying presidents the ability to pardon co-conspirators, I think that's another important piece of legislation. If Congress is quiet, if it's not just handing over power, that's the worst thing that it can do, but if it's neglectful in curbing it, the default is that presidents are going to claim it. And that's certainly what we've seen, unfortunately, over a growing period of time since the demise of those reforms from the Ford and Carter era.
Going back to my original question about how the Trump presidency will influence the office and power of the presidency after that presidency is over, whether it's 2021 or 2025, I'm interested in, you write quite a bit in the book about the bully pulpit power of the presidency. Mm. We've seen now the Twitter fiat become a new power of the presidency. Do you think that's going to last?
I do. I mean, I think, you know, the bully pulpit formally refers to the power of the president to speak using the press, and it's connected deeply to the creation of the office of the press office within the White House. But think of the difference between that power and Twitter. That relies on a press that's going to report what the president says. So those years of press conferences of presidents like Kennedy charming the press corps, that charm was crucial to how they were able to get their message out. That's no longer true. Trump can go on Twitter, and a future president can go on Twitter and send their message directly to the American people. And then it's the press reporting what was said directly. They're not needed as a mediating institution. That's even more power for an office. By the way, over 2.5 million employees are in the executive branch. It's the largest by far. And the bully pulpit is among the powers of the president, two informal powers that make it, I think, the most powerful branch. And all the more reason why it has to be constrained.
So you don't think the Twitter attacks against opponents making policy through Twitter tweets are going to go away with a new president?
Well, I hope so. You know, I guess when I say, I should be more specific, that I think the power of Twitter won't go away. Presidents will see what Trump has shown, which is that this is an amazingly powerful tool. There's no constitutional mechanism to keep a president from using it and continuing to use it. But I think what the American people have to say about this president is that he's abused that power. And the tweets, you know, that inflame racism rather than curb it have to be called out as a violation of constitutional duty. Courts aren't going to do it, but that's what we, the American people, have to do it. Now, where are we going to do it? It's about this election. And I think, you know, I'll just be blunt, that if you care about democracy and you care about the abuse of the president's power, including the power to speak on behalf of the American people, this president is not speaking on behalf of the American people. He's speaking on behalf of a segment, and he is not opposing white supremacy in the way the Constitution requires. We fought a civil war about that issue. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments are repudiations of white supremacy, and this president hasn't made good on that. Now, how do we stop him? We've got to do what happened in the election of 1800, when the population of the United States pushed back against a president who had abused power, and that Alien and Sedition Act outlawing criticism of the president. We've got to repudiate this president for failing to speak out against white supremacy. And that's about this election.
Well, one of the things your book, The Oath and the Office, does is talk about the Constitution and how it relates to a president. And there's one clause that I think most Americans were blissfully unaware of, that we knew common sense that a president shouldn't be involved with the subject of that clause. But that's the emoluments clause.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I just want to ask you, do you think that clause has been eviscerated, or that after the Trump presidency, whenever that is, courts will rule on what this clause means today and how it will be governed? Because this is the thing about this clause. It's in the Constitution, but there's no penalty for violating it. There's no meaning to what that clause pertains to, except that you shouldn't accept gifts from foreign governments.
Right. You know, it's a clause that is so central to the meaning of the entire Constitution, and yet it has such a bad brand. What is an emolument? It sounds like some sort of soup or something they put on a wound. Its meaning, though, exactly as you say, is that the president can't use the office for personal profit. So when Donald Trump goes and seeks intellectual property from China for businesses related to himself and his family, and he, you know, one second is criticizing China, and then that property is granted, and that criticism is dropped. I'm bringing up, this is in the Washington, D.C. and Maryland case against the president, based on the Maryland worrying about a violation of the Foreign Emoluments Clause. That's a real worry for democracy. It's using the office for profit rather than for foreign goods. It harkens back to a worry that monarchs were using foreign relations to enrich themselves rather than to care about the common good. That isn't just a, by the way, part of the Constitution. To me, it's the core part of everything that we've been talking about. That oath to preserve the Constitution is about respecting the law and respecting the common good, not putting oneself above the office. And the Emoluments Clause was meant to codify that. So I think if courts don't enforce that clause against these abuses of power by the president, they failed in their duty. But that is another place where if we want to really care about future presidents, Congress has to act. It has to clarify that presidents can't be seeking personal profit as they do diplomacy, as they do domestic politics. And we've seen this failure of the president to respect that. That has to be codified, and there have to be, I think, penalties. Now, the other place that the Emoluments Clause should be enforced is in impeachment. And we had this very narrow impeachment focused on this Ukraine phone call. The president called it a perfect call. I think it was an example of an abuse of power. But Congress failed there, too, in not bringing up the emoluments violations, in not bringing up the failures of presidential speech. It should have been a much broader impeachment in the way that the impeachment of Andrew Johnson was, and it was too narrow in my opinion. So the emoluments failure is a failure of courts so far, but maybe not. Maybe they'll come through. And it's certainly a failure of Congress to act to clarify when there is an emoluments violation and what the penalties are.
Let me ask you about another power. We've talked a little bit about that as executive orders. The powers wielded by them are enormous. Again, courts will sometimes intervene, but other times won't in situations where it just seems, it doesn't matter if it's a Democratic or Republican administration, it seems like it's circumventing lawmaking process. And the orders are out there. They wield enormous power and influence. It's unimaginable to presidents a generation ago that they could bypass the legislative process along with signing statements on laws that are passed. Where do you stand on where the Constitution speaks to this executive power?
I think presidents have leaned on it too heavily. I criticize Obama in the book for really failing to make it clear that if he was going to use an executive order to protect Dreamers, that their rights were still not secure. Of course, as we've seen it play out, all it took was another executive order to. Now, there's, you know, back and forth about this, but I would say that the rights have been in jeopardy as a result of relying on an executive order, not legislation. And then I think there's just a lot of overreach. Some executive orders are completely benign. I'm not against them, period. The first executive order, for instance, was just a request by Washington to find out and a kind of audit of what was going on within his administration, what each of the different employees was doing. But they also can be abused. So I mentioned the Wall case briefly, but I think that is an example that I'm really worried about, of using an executive order to do what Congress really said it wouldn't do. There was a request for Congress to fund the wall. Congress considered it and rejected it. To my mind, you know, the famous Youngstown case is about this, where Truman wanted to seize a steel mill, and he wanted the power to do so during a strike. The Congress considered it, rejected that ability to give the president that power. And the courts in the Youngstown case said, sorry, you know, when Congress says no, that limits the president's power. Now, here, I would like to see them say the same thing very clearly. But the problem is that the president has this Emergencies Act in which Congress has simultaneously, as it has the power to stop a president, handed over lots of power. So is the court going to stop the building of the wall? I'm not optimistic about that. But that's a sign of that we've really eviscerated that lawmaking power of Congress. I'm also worried about the investigatory powers of Congress. The court kind of punted on a recent case about whether or not Congress can investigate the executive branch through the use of subpoenas. And I think if the, you know, if Congress has charged ultimately with deciding whether to impeach a president, whether the president's done wrong, it's got to have the power to investigate a president.
I want to ask you one last question. This is something I've observed from young people. I've heard it from a number of sources, and of course this is anecdotal, but this Constitution, this 18th century governing document, is unequal to the task of being a governing document in the 21st century. It's so difficult to amend. It takes such a high level of bar to change what the Constitution means as far as the amendment process. And you know, it is an archaic document for 21st century life. What is your thought on, I wonder if it's something you hear in your classes, that young people look at the Constitution as being unequal to the task of governing today?
Yeah, I certainly do hear that a lot. And before this administration, there were a number of books that said something like that. There was a book called Relic, and the Relic was the Constitution, and another one called The Executive Unbound. And what they argued was that, you know, to be equal to the task of governing, we should give all the power over to the president and let the president basically collapse the judiciary, the legislative branch, and the ability to get things done, and that efficiency is the main thing here. Now, I think that's a mistake. You know, once we start moving around away from the Constitution, we see it as a relic. We endanger our rights. That's what the framers got right, that we don't want to hand over all the power to an executive branch. We want the power to be retained by the people, to, of course, have an efficient administration, but one that's constrained by democracy and constrained by rights. So I think getting rid of it would be a mistake. Its design is meant to empower the people and yet allow for efficient operation of government. The fact that we've failed to do that as much as we have is something that we could correct, I think, often through ordinary legislation. If you go back through our conversation today, the War Powers Act, the Emergency Act that I've talked about, the need for an independent prosecutor, those are all things that have been done and could be done through new legislation. So I would like to see not an abandonment of the Constitution, but a revival of it through an act of Congress and through an act of polity that demands that this thing live up to its potential and that it work the way that it has worked in the past and that it certainly could work in the future. So no, I don't want to abandon it. I want it to be made work the way it's supposed to.
It's really interesting. The last amendment was of whether a congressional official can raise his own pay.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there are good principles in there, right? That we don't want people to be judges in their own case, that no person is above the law. And at the court's best moments, it demands that we live up to it, and public officials demand that we live up to it. But, you know, we also fall short at different points. And I guess my hope is that this is not a good moment for the Constitution. I think I've made that clear. It's not a partisan point. It's that this president doesn't understand the Constitution. He hasn't read it. He doesn't respect it. And he's often violated it and spoken against its basic values. And that presents an opportunity, though. It's an opportunity to revive this document and to recover from this presidency.
Corey Bretschneider, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Corey Bretschneider is a professor of political science at Brown University and the author of the 2018 book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. It's published by Norton. He'll be speaking today at the University of Tulsa, their Phi Beta Kappa public lecture, this afternoon at 5 o'clock on his book. For information on how to view the lecture virtually, visit the events page, the events calendar at the University of Tulsa's website at utulsa.edu. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.